The pistol discharged before the man had meant it to, and Marion Linton was already moving. She did not think about it afterwards. Not then, not in the moment that followed, not in the strange suspended silence after the sound had cracked through the dusk and the horses had screamed and the highwayman had stood there looking at his own hand as though it had betrayed him. She had simply moved. The Duke had been nearest the carriage door, nearest the barrel of the thing, and the man's grip had slipped on the rain-wet stock, and the flash had come, and Marion had put herself between them with the unhesitating reflex of a woman who had spent her whole life doing whatever needed doing without waiting to be asked. The ball grazed her left side, just beneath the lowest rib. She felt it as heat first, then as a bright thin line of something too immediate to be called pain. Her hand went to it. Her fingers found the torn muslin, found the wetness beneath, and she pressed hard and said nothing. The highwayman ran. He was young. She saw that in the half second before he turned, young and thin and utterly terrified by what his weapon had done without his permission. His boots slipped on the wet road, and he disappeared into the hedgerow with the graceless urgency of a boy fleeing a schoolmaster. Then there was only the sound of the horses and the coachman swearing, and the Duke's voice asking if she was harmed. "No," Marion said. Her hand was still pressed to her side. "No, I am quite well, only startled." Benedict Thorold, Duke of Austerlitz, looked at her across the dim interior of the carriage with the sharp attention of a man who has just heard a pistol discharge 6 inches from his chest and is not yet certain which parts of the world remain intact. His gaze moved over her face, her posture, her hands. She held herself very still and kept her expression mild and her breathing steady and did not allow her fingers to tremble where they rested against the torn fabric beneath her pelisse. "You are certain?" he said. "Entirely," he believed her. She was very composed. The coachman gathered the horses. The carriage moved on. The remaining 11 miles to Austerlitz passed in a quiet that Marion maintained with the same careful attention she brought to everything, the same attention she had brought 2 seasons ago to not staring at the Duke across the assembly room at Thornham, and 1 season ago to not blushing when he had asked her opinion on a point of local history, and she had given it with rather more fluency than she had intended, and 6 hours ago to sitting beside him in this carriage as though the proximity were nothing remarkable, as though her pulse were not doing something inadvisable every time his knee came within 3 inches of hers on a rough patch of road. She was the daughter of Reverend John Linton of Thornham, a man who had taught her, among other things, that the world did not require her feelings on the matter. It required her competence. Her father had buried 2 wives and 3 parishioners in a single winter and had returned to his study each evening to continue his work on the minor prophets without, as far as Marion could tell, ever once raising his voice or sitting down to feel sorry for himself. She had inherited this quality. She thought of it not as stoicism, but as practicality. The wound beneath her hand was bleeding. Bleeding could be addressed. Bleeding was not, in the catalogue of problems she had managed in her 23 years, particularly unusual. What would be unusual, what would be intolerable, would be to say something. To lift her hand and show him the blood and watch his face change from the composed civility of a man doing a neighborly courtesy to the horrified gratitude of a man who has been saved by a woman he barely knows, and now owes something he does not know how to repay. She did not want his gratitude. She did not want the fuss of it, the obligation of it, the way it would rearrange whatever fragile, careful, unremarkable thing existed between them into something shaped by debt. If she was honest, and Marion was almost always honest except in this single matter, she wanted something quite different from gratitude, and gratitude would make that other thing impossible. So she pressed her hand to the wound and watched the dark countryside past the carriage window and said nothing. They arrived at Austerlitz Hall at 7:30. The Duke alighted first and turned to offer her his hand. She took it with her right, her left was occupied, though he could not see this in the darkness, and stepped down onto the gravel with a care that she disguised as the ordinary caution of a woman in evening shoes on an uneven drive. The housekeeper, Mrs. Crail, was at the door. The hall was lit. A supper had been laid. "Miss Linton will be continuing to her father's house after supper," the Duke said to Mrs. Crail. "See that the small carriage is readied." "I am not hungry," Marion said. "If the carriage could be brought now, I should be grateful. My father will be expecting me." The Duke studied her. She felt his attention like a hand placed carefully on a bruise, but she met it steadily. She was good at meeting things steadily. "Of course," he said. "I hope the journey was not too alarming." "Not at all. These things are more noise than danger, I find." She climbed into the smaller carriage alone, pressed both hands to her side the moment the door closed, and did not make a sound for the entire 4 miles to the rectory. Polly was waiting. Polly was always waiting, because Polly had been with her since Marion was 14 and had developed the particular instinct of a lady's maid who knows her mistress better than her mistress would prefer. She saw the blood before Marion had removed her pelisse. "Miss Linton, it is a graze. I've had worse from the Hargroves fence." This was not true, but it was the kind of thing Marion said, and Polly recognized the tone, the calm, the mild deflection, the absolute prohibition against fuss, and set her mouth and said nothing further, and fetched water and clean linen and the small pot of salve that Marion kept in her dressing case for burns and scrapes and the various minor injuries that attended life in a household where one did things oneself. The wound was as she had described, a graze, perhaps 4 inches long, shallow enough that the ball had not lodged, but deep enough that the skin was opened and the flesh beneath was raw and furious. It would heal. It would leave a mark. It would hurt considerably for some days, particularly when she moved or breathed deeply or sat in a way that required her to bend at the waist. "You will tell no one," Marion said, as Polly bound the linen tight. "No, miss." "I mean it, Polly." "I know you do, miss." Marion lay awake that night in her narrow bed in the rectory and listened to the wind in the elm trees and thought about the sound the pistol had made and the way the Duke's face had looked in the flash. Not afraid exactly, but very alert, very present, the face of a man who understood immediately that something serious was happening and did not flinch from it. She thought about his hand reaching for her in the darkness of the carriage, a reflexive gesture, protective, withdrawn the moment he saw she was upright and speaking. She thought about the 11 miles of quiet that had followed, and the way he had looked at her when they arrived, and the particular quality of his voice when he had said, "I hope the journey was not too alarming." He had not known. He truly had not known. She turned on her right side, because her left was impossible, and closed her eyes, and did not sleep until nearly 3. The following morning, she rose early and dressed before Polly could come to help, because dressing required the careful lifting of her chemise over the bandage and the particular arrangement of her stays so that the boning did not press the wound. And these were negotiations she preferred to conduct privately, by candlelight, with her teeth set together. The graze had bled again in the night, a small bloom on the linen, and she changed the binding herself, standing at the washstand with the basin, and noted that the edges were clean and the flesh around it warm but not dangerously so. She had dressed worse on her younger brother before he had gone away to school. A split knee from the churchyard wall. A burn from a candle he had been told not to touch. She had been 12 and matter of fact, and her father had said, without looking up from his desk, that she had good hands. She went down to breakfast and sat carefully and drank her tea and answered her father's questions about the journey, the road conditions, the state of the weather, whether the Duke had mentioned the boundary dispute with Sir Edward, and said nothing about the pistol, and nothing about the highwayman, and nothing about the moment on a dark road when she had put herself between a loaded weapon and a man she was not supposed to love. The Duke of Austerlitz had come into the country that spring for reasons Marion understood only partially. He had estates in 3 counties, a house in London that he used during the sitting of the House of Lords, and the kind of obligations that kept a man of his rank in constant purposeful motion between responsibilities. But he had come to Austerlitz this year earlier than usual, and stayed longer, and the county had noticed. There were rumors, a broken engagement, a political disappointment, a quarrel with the family of a girl his mother had favored. But Marion did not trade in rumors. What she knew was simpler and more direct. He had been at 3 of the last 4 assemblies, which was unusual. He had spoken to her at 2 of them, which was extraordinary, and he had offered her the use of his carriage when her father's had thrown a wheel on the Farnley Road, which was either the most natural courtesy in the world or something else entirely, depending on how one chose to read it. She chose not to read it. She was a clergyman's daughter with an income of nothing and expectations to match, and she had learned, very young, that hope was best managed by keeping it small and practical. Hope for the new calf to survive. Hope for the roof not to leak this winter. Not hope for a duke. Never hope for a duke. But the carriage had been intimate in a way she had not anticipated. The closeness of the space, the privacy of the road, the conversation that had moved from polite observation to something denser and more candid as the miles passed and the light failed. He had asked about her reading. She had admitted to having opinions about agricultural reform. He had not laughed. He had asked what they were. She had told him and then been appalled at herself and then noticed that he was listening. Actually listening, not performing the courtesy of attention while thinking about something else. And felt something open in her chest that she had spent two seasons carefully keeping shut. And then the pistol had fired, and she had moved, and none of it mattered now because she had a wound beneath her ribs and a secret she intended to keep and a Thursday assembly to survive. The 3 days passed. She dressed the wound twice daily, wore her loosest stays, and declined two invitations, one to walk with the Pemberley sisters, one to take tea with Mrs. Foyle at the vicarage on the grounds of a mild headache. Her father, absorbed in Zechariah, did not notice. Polly noticed everything but said nothing, as instructed, and brought Marion her meals on a tray. When bending to sit at the dining table proved inadvisable and pressed her lips together in a way that communicated without words that she thought her mistress was being an idiot. On the Thursday morning, Marion stood before her glass and considered the problem of the assembly with the practical attention of a woman assessing a fortification. She could not dance. Dancing required movement of the torso, extension of the arms, postures that would pull the wound open, and possibly, this was the part she did not allow herself to think about too carefully, cause her to make a sound. She could not sit comfortably, because sitting bent the waist. She could stand if she stood carefully, and she could speak, and she could hold a glass of negus, and she could do all of this while wearing a shawl that covered the place where the bandage made a faint ridge beneath her dress. She chose the Norwich shawl. Cream wool with a border of pale blue, large enough to drape properly, ordinary enough to attract no comment. She chose a dress of white muslin with a high waist that did not press the wound. She dressed her own hair because Polly's hands, reaching around her, would require Marion to hold positions she could not hold without flinching. "You should not go," Polly said from the doorway. "I always go. You are hurt, miss. I am grazed. There's a difference." Polly said nothing further, but her silence had a texture to it that Marion chose to ignore. The assembly room at Thornham was warm with candlelight and the particular hum of a country gathering, 30 families who knew each other well enough to be either comfortable or dangerous. Marion arrived with her father, who greeted the curate and the churchwarden and disappeared into a corner to discuss a disputed boundary with Sir Edward Foyle, and she stood near the window with a glass she did not drink, and her shawl arranged with a precision that she hoped looked careless. The Duke arrived at 8:30. She saw him before he saw her. She always saw him before he saw her, because she had trained herself over two seasons to know where he was in a room without appearing to look, and she watched him cross the threshold with his mother on his arm and felt the particular tightening in her chest that she had learned to manage and could not learn to prevent. Lady Austerley was visiting from Bath. Marion knew this because everyone in Thornham knew it, and because Lady Austerley's visits were events that rearranged the social furniture of the entire county. She was a small woman with excellent posture and the attentive, cataloging gaze of a woman who had raised a duke and intended to see him properly settled. She had a candidate. Everyone in Thornham knew this, too. Miss Carew, the daughter of Lord Carew of Farnley, pretty, accomplished, well-connected, and possessed of the kind of easy social grace that Marion, standing by the window in her shawl with a wound she was declining to mention, could not have performed if her life had depended upon it. Miss Carew was across the room now, smiling, her dress a soft rose silk that caught the candlelight, her hand resting lightly on the arm of young Mr. Aldwick, as though physical ease with other human beings were the simplest thing in the world. Lady Austerley was watching her with the quiet satisfaction of a woman whose plans are proceeding. Marion stood very still and held her glass and watched none of this and thought about how, in 3 days, she had not once considered telling anyone what had happened on the road. Not her father, who would have been distressed, not Mrs. Foyle, who would have told everyone, not the Duke himself, who would have been, what? Grateful, appalled, obligated. All the things she did not want him to be, because she wanted him to look at her as he had looked at her in the carriage before the pistol fired, With the quiet interest of a man who found her conversation worth having, her company worth seeking, her opinions worth the asking. Not as a woman who had done something dramatic and now required a response. She had not been dramatic. She had simply moved. She wished people could understand the difference. The Duke found her at 9:15. She'd been aware of his approach for some minutes, aware of the way the crowd shifted subtly to accommodate his movement through it, the way conversations paused and resumed in his wake. And she had composed herself accordingly, which meant she had not moved at all. "Miss Linton, you are not dancing." "I am not, Your Grace. You danced at the last assembly, the second set, I believe, with Mr. Hadwell." He had noticed. She had not known he had noticed. She filed this information in the place where she kept such things, the place she did not examine too frequently, because examining it made her feel like a fool, and she was not a fool. She was a clergyman's daughter who dressed her own wounds and did not require rescue. 2 seasons of careful indifference, and he had been watching closely enough to remember which set and which partner. "I am content to watch this evening," she said. He looked at her. It was the same look he had given her in the carriage, attentive, unhurried, as though he were reading a passage in a language he mostly understood but wished to be certain of. His gaze moved briefly to the shawl, to the way she was standing, very upright, very still, her weight shifted slightly to her right side. "You are pale," he said. "The room is warm. You're holding yourself as though something hurts." Her heart did something unpleasant. "I am perfectly well, Your Grace." "You declined the Pemberley walk. You declined tea with Mrs. Foyle. Your maid has been seen fetching linen from the apothecary." He paused. "I made inquiries. Discreetly." Marion felt the blood leave her face, not from the wound, but from the sudden, vertiginous understanding that he had been paying attention. Not the casual attention of a man who happened to notice a neighbor's absence, but the specific, deliberate attention of a man who had reason to notice and had acted on it. "Miss Linton," he said, and his voice had changed. It was quieter now, and there was something beneath the civility that she had not heard before, something careful and serious and very nearly afraid. "What happened in the carriage?" "Nothing happened in the carriage. A man fired a pistol and missed and ran away." "He did not miss." The room continued around them. The music played. Miss Carew laughed at something across the room, a bright, easy sound. Lady Austerly was watching from beside the hearth, her gaze moving between her son and the clergyman's daughter in the Norwich shawl, and her expression was not pleased. "He did not miss," the Duke said again. "Did he?" Marion looked at him. She had spent 2 seasons training herself not to look at him directly for longer than propriety allowed, and now she looked at him and could not stop, because his face held an expression she had not anticipated. Not gratitude, not horror, not the performative concern of a man who felt he ought to be concerned, but something raw and less manageable. Something that looked, if she were brave enough to name it, like the beginning of an understanding that rearranged everything. "It is a graze," she said quietly. "It is healing. I have managed it. There is nothing to be done and nothing to be said, and I would very much prefer..." "You took the blow." "It was not a blow, it was a ball, and I did not take it so much as fail to move out of its way quickly enough." "You moved toward me." "I moved toward me." "Eden, you put yourself between the pistol and me, and you did not say a word. Not in the carriage, not at supper, not in 3 days." "Your Grace." "Why?" She could have said, because it was nothing. Because it was the practical thing, the immediate thing, and I'm a practical and immediate person. Because I did not want to alarm you. Because I did not want to be a burden. Because I have spent my entire life managing things quietly. And this was simply one more thing to manage. She could have said any of that, and it would have been true, and it would not have been the truth. "Because I did not want you to feel obligated," she said. And then, before she could prevent it, before the composure she had maintained for 3 days and 2 seasons and the whole of her careful, self-sufficient life could stop the words, "I did not want gratitude, Your Grace, if you must know. I want something that gratitude would have made impossible, and I would rather have the wound than the debt." The room was very loud around them and very far away. The Duke looked at her for a long moment. She watched something move behind his eyes, surprise, recognition, the adjustment of a man who has been looking at a familiar landscape, and has suddenly seen it from an entirely different elevation. He did not speak. She did not speak. The candles burned. Miss Carew danced. Lady Austerly watched. Then Benedict Thorold, Duke of Austerly, did something that the assembly at Thornham discussed for the remainder of the season and well into the next. He did not ask her to dance. He knew she could not dance. He knew now why. He asked if he might sit with her. There were chairs along the wall, the chairs reserved for the elderly and the infirm, and the wallflowers, the chairs that no man of his rank and age and eligibility would voluntarily occupy at an assembly where Miss Carew was dancing, and his mother was watching, and every family in the county was taking note of where his attention fell. He drew one out. He placed it beside hers. He sat. "What are you doing?" Marion said. "Sitting. Your mother is watching." "Yes. Miss Carew is dancing. I'm aware. The entire room will talk." "I expect so." He did not mention the wound. He did not mention the carriage. He did not mention what she had said, the raw, inadvertent confession that she had meant to swallow and had not. He simply sat beside her and talked to her of small things: the curate's new dog, the state of the Thornham Road, the surprising quality of the negus this quarter, and made it clear, by where he was and where he was not, what he had decided. He stayed for the entire assembly. 2 hours. He rose once to fetch her a fresh glass and returned to the same chair and sat down again with the unhurried certainty of a man who is exactly where he means to be. Marion sat beside him and held her shawl and felt the wound ache beneath it and felt something else too, something larger and warmer and more terrifying than the ache, and understood that she had been seen. Not as a woman who had done something brave and deserved recognition, but as a woman who had done something quiet and meant it and wanted no reward, and that the absence of wanting a reward was, to him, the most significant thing she could have done. Lady Austerly crossed the room at 10:30. She stood before them and looked at her son, seated in a wallflower's chair with a clergyman's daughter, and then she looked at Marion, and her gaze dropped, very briefly, very precisely, to the place where the shawl was arranged with such careful attention over Marion's left side. "Miss Linton," she said, "you're not dancing this evening." "No, Lady Austerly." The dowager studied her. It was the same cataloging attention she had brought to every eligible woman in the county for the past 2 years, but there was something different in it now, a recalibration, a reassessment, the adjustment of a woman who has understood something she had not previously considered. "You must come to tea," Lady Austerly said, "tomorrow, at the hall." She did not wait for an answer. She turned and walked back to the hearth, and Miss Carew smiled at her uncertainly, and the assembly continued, and the Duke remained where he was. Marion went to tea. Lady Austerly poured good china, the kind that was brought out for assessments rather than hospitality, and asked the questions that mothers of dukes ask about family, about accomplishments, about household management, about what Marion read and whether she played and how she spent her mornings, without embellishment, in the manner of a woman who had nothing to perform and no pretenses to maintain. At some point during the second cup, Lady Austerly said quite calmly, "My son tells me you were injured in the carriage." "It was a graze, Lady Austerly." "He tells me you said nothing." "There was nothing to say." Lady Austerly set down her cup with the careful precision of a woman making a decision. "There is a great deal to say, Miss Linton, but I find I agree with you that most of it is better left unsaid." She paused. "You will stay for dinner." It was not a question. Marion stayed for dinner. The courtship that followed was unlike anything Thornham had witnessed. It was quiet, direct, entirely without performance. The Duke called at the rectory, not with the ceremonial approach of a man making a social declaration, but with the unhurried regularity of a man who had found the place he wished to be, and saw no reason to complicate the matter. He walked with Marion along the river path, where the willows dragged their new growth in the current, and the light came through the canopy in patterns that shifted with the wind. He asked her opinion on the management of the Austerly tenant farms, and listened to her answers with the attention of a man who intended to act on them. When she suggested that the cottages on the north boundary needed their roofs seen to before autumn, he had Jessop attend to it the following week, and mentioned it to her only in passing, as though it were the most natural thing in the world to take instruction from a woman who was not yet his wife, and had no formal authority to give it. He did not bring flowers. He did not make speeches. He sat with her father in the rectory study and discussed the minor prophets with the genuine interest of a man who had read them, and Reverend Linton, who had spent 30 years in quiet scholarship and was not easily impressed by rank or manners, found himself engaged in a conversation about the dating of Habakkuk that lasted longer than either of them had intended and ended only when Marian brought tea and pointed out that the light had gone. Her father began to look at his daughter with the startled recognition of a man who has failed to notice something important happening under his own roof. He said nothing. Reverend Linton was not a man who said things prematurely, but he began, in his quiet way, to leave them alone in the garden more frequently, and to find reasons to return to his study when the Duke called, and to treat the situation with the same composed attention he brought to a difficult text. Read it carefully. Let it reveal itself. Do not force the interpretation. The Duke asked her on a Tuesday. They were walking in the Austerley Gardens, the formal gardens not yet in bloom, the beds bare and waiting, and he stopped on the gravel path and turned to her and said, "Miss Linton, I should like to marry you, not because of what happened on the road, and not because of what you said at the assembly, but because I have not, since that evening, wished to sit beside anyone else. I find I do not think I shall." She said yes, but not immediately. There was a pause first, not hesitation, not uncertainty, but the particular stillness of a woman who was making certain she meant it, who had spent her whole life doing things because they were practical and immediate and necessary, and wished, for this single thing, to do it because she wanted to, wholly and without qualification. "Yes," she said, "I should like that very much." They were married in June, in Thornham Church, by her father, who performed the service with the composed precision of a man who had conducted 1,000 ceremonies, but had perhaps not expected to conduct this one, and whose voice wavered only once at the vows before he collected himself and carried on. The church was full, not the grand congregation of a London wedding, but the steady, particular fullness of a community that has watched something happen and wishes to witness its conclusion. Mrs. Crail had the house ready. Jessop had the accounts in order. Lady Austerley sat in the front pew and wore an expression that was not quite a smile, but was very close to one. And when Marian came down the aisle, in white muslin, without fuss, without a tremor, she nodded, once, firmly. And that was enough. Marian took to the management of Austerley with the same quiet competence she had brought to every other undertaking in her life. The household ran through Mrs. Crail, who had served 3 generations of Thorolds, and who recognized, within a fortnight, that the new Duchess understood the difference between authority and interference. Marian consulted with Jessop on matters of tenancy and yield and drainage with the same practical intelligence she had brought to running the rectory on £40 a year. And the tenants, who had liked the old Duke and respected the young one and had not known what to make of a clergyman's daughter, found that she remembered their children's names and the state of their fences and which fields flooded in a wet March, and they trusted her accordingly. The wound healed. It left a thin, pale line beneath her lowest rib, a mark she could feel with her fingertips when she dressed in the morning, a reminder of a moment on a dark road when she had moved without thinking and changed everything by refusing to mention it. The Duke saw it, of course, in time. He traced it once, very gently, in the quiet of their bedchamber, and said nothing. And she understood that the nothing was the point, that he honored the wound best by not making it into a story, because she had never wanted it to be a story. She had wanted it to be what it was, a thing she had done, quietly, because it was the thing to do. Lady Austerley, who visited from Bath each autumn, and stayed precisely long enough to assure herself that the household was well run and the children well fed, deferred to Marian on questions of domestic management with a brevity that was, from Lady Austerley, the highest possible compliment. She had never mentioned Miss Carew again after the assembly. She had instead, on her second visit, brought Marian a length of Norwich silk, good silk, the kind that spoke of approval rather than charity, and said only, "For the winter. You will need something warm for the House of Lords sitting." It was the closest Lady Austerley had ever come to an embrace, and Marian had received it as such. They had 2 children, a son first, then a daughter, both healthy, both possessed of their mother's composure and their father's attentiveness. The nursery at Austerlee was warm and well-run, and Marion could sometimes be found there in the afternoons, not because the nursemaid required assistance, but because she liked the sound of her children's voices echoing in a house that had been, before her arrival, rather too quiet. Years later, enough years that the pistol on the Thornham Road had become a story other people told, not one they lived, the Duke found the shawl. The Norwich shawl, cream wool with a border of pale blue, folded carefully at the back of her wardrobe behind the winter things, preserved with a care that suggested it was not merely a shawl. He had been looking for something else. He lifted it out and held it, and recognized it immediately. The shawl she had worn to the assembly, the shawl that had covered the wound she had carried for 3 days without a word. And he stood there, in the quiet of the dressing room, with the wool in his hands and did not move for some time. Marion found him there. She stood in the doorway and saw what he was holding and saw his face and said nothing. He looked at her. She looked at him. The afternoon light came through the window and fell across the shawl and across his hands and across the space between them that was not a space at all but a shared understanding, maintained for years without ever being spoken aloud, that some things did not require words because the words had already been said, not in language, but in a chair drawn out at an assembly, in a man who sat down and did not move, in a woman who had taken the blow and kept it quiet and wanted, if she was honest, something quite different from gratitude. Neither of them spoke. Some things are better told in silence by the people who understand that silence is not absence, but a kind of presence, a way of saying everything by declining to say anything at all. They arrive here like a wound that healed clean and left only a mark that means something whenever they are ready.